This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Why are you being taken to the Human Rights Commission?
Because people complained.
About what?
About an episode I did with DJ Spoon in the Hustler's Corner. So the episode was basically about what's happening in current affairs, and we were responding to a lot of the agitation that's been going around, accusing, you know, a lot of South Africans of being anti-white or being reverse racist. And with that, you know, they became calls for people to go to the United States and appeal for the government there to sanction some of our leaders.
Afrikaners.
Yeah, well, you know, so-called Afrikaners. I prefer to call them so-called Afrikaners because, you know, Afrikaners are a very diverse group as well. And there are certain groups that seem to want to create an exclusive enclave for certain kinds of Afrikaners. And yeah, so a lot of people were listening to that and saw the clips of the episode. And because of the clips that went viral, you know, even being reposted by Elon Musk, people sent complaints to the Human Rights Commission alleging that, you know, some of my statements were dehumanizing or, you know, reducing their dignity. When in actual fact, you know, that wasn't the intention of anything that I was saying on that podcast episode. You know, it wasn't to dehumanize or whatever. It was referring to our cultures, you know, in terms of the whole entire Ubuntu thing. You know, our cultures did not come about in the same type of environment. Europe was a very contested space. If you've read the history of Europe and how it was formed, you know, it's been lots of battles, lots of wars, and a lot of their technology, well, their war technology, has improved to the rate at which they could commit atrocities at scale. Like, you know, like what would be acts of war are, you know, typically mass murders. Whereas if you look at within the African context, you know, pre-colonial conflict wasn't really about the use of, you know, technologies such as bombs, guns, you know, rifles. It was arrows, spears, stuff like that. Stuff that doesn't really cause, you know, mass murder at scale. So when those two cultures end up colliding, right, the dominant culture is the one that's more advanced technologically. And that's why so few European settlers were able to overcome the defenses of the native people that they found here. You know, they fought with the Khoi in the sand in the Cape for over 100 years. The same with the Xhosa nations, you know what I mean, for also over 100 years. You know, for almost 50 years, they fought with the Zulus, all prior to there being, you know, settler colonial conflict with the Anglo-Boer War, when the British eventually took over the Boer Republics and unified South Africa. So coming from that culture, and a culture that, you know, has a need for a level of brutality that could only, you know, it's very hard to, you know, expand it, but I try to put it as simply as possible, in that, you know, the native or the African cultures weren't as, you know, violent in their nature. Yes, there was conflict, but not at the scale that we'd seen in any of the colonial wars. nothing at the scale of what happened in the first Boer War and by the end of the second Boer War. So those differences as well makes it very difficult for especially native South Africans in the old context, that is, you know, to understand that although we are currently looking to finding a freedom or finding a unity within our nation, there are certain people whose culture just stops them from having the requisite amount of empathy for what had happened because it is their culture. They have to sort of like, you know, live with it and embody it, you know. I don't think there's any white person in South Africa that has been naturalized or has lived here for a long time that wants to be pointed out in the streets and be called a settler, you know what I mean? But that history is there, you know, and we cannot erase it. But what is the identity of the descendants of the settlers currently? You know, the identity of the descendants of the settlers is that they are white South Africans right now. And that comes with their history. For there to be, you know, white South Africans in existence, they needed to be something that put them here. And what put them here also involves, you know, the subjugation of the black natives, you know, or the African natives, the subjugation of even the indentured servants or slave laborers that were shipped into our shores. And that creates a dynamic or a relational dynamic or a power dynamic as well between white South Africans and black South Africans. That means that, you know, when we are trying to find common ground, we are not looking at it from the perspective of the oppressor and the victim. We're looking at it as, you know, people who are just supposed to move on as if their past didn't happen, and they're supposed to pick up where history left off and create a society that is meritocratic. But, you know, wealth is heritable, and there is no real meritocracy in our system currently. And it's very difficult then for any well-meaning black person, right, to tell other black people that you need to move on. There's no reason to be angry anymore. There's lots of opportunities right now. We can't be dwelling in the past. Meanwhile, those people are still feeling the effects of the oppression. They're still feeling the effects of apartheid and colonialism. And they still feel angry about it. And when they feel angry about it and they want to confront, like whether it be fellow white South Africans about it, you know, they're dismissed as if, you know, stop crying over spilt milk. It's in the past. And dismissing people and their valid, I guess, I don't know, you know, they feel hard done by. And if you dismiss them for long enough, you're going to make them angry to the point where they want to take drastic measures to either feel as if they've gotten some form of revenge, or at least that, you know, they've expressed enough rejection of the current system and the current status quo that they feel satisfied with themselves, that they, you know, didn't just roll over and play dead. So yeah, that's a long way of putting what I put in those simple terms, you know. Metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, so I just want to state for the record, and I've said this for a long time, social media and the media, in my view, is absolutely not a reflection of how South Africa actually is. It is a sensational hyped up version in my dealings in my life. From traveling around the country, I find race relations generally to be pretty good. I don't know if you have the same experience. Yeah. I don't find race relations to be nearly as bad as what Facebook or X would say. That's the first thing. But the second thing is you made a lot of statements also worth unpacking. And it's very interesting, the whole settler thing. So let's talk about that for a second. Will there ever be, in your view, a point at which the term settler no longer applies? I mean, it's been a few centuries now. So will it ever fall away, or will it always be a settler?
Well, I think that depends on the descendants of settlers, is whether they see themselves as naturalized Africans or whether they see themselves as settlers. And, I alluded to that in that episode, because even when we started the conversation and the dialogue at the beginning, I did say, if you go outside, our relations are not what they're being made out to be by, the AfriForums or, whoever else. Even IRR, I think, they're on the other side of the spectrum in terms of their analysis of our race relations, and black and white people have frustrations about each other, and we have got culture clashes all the time, and black culture clashes with white culture all the time, and we can swear at each other in traffic or anything else, but it's not like we're going out getting guns and killing one another. So that's because the identity of South Africans, especially, the descendants of the settlers, white South Africans in the main, most of them identify themselves as being South Africans. They don't see themselves as having another home, right? But they're not a monolith, because they're also divided amongst themselves. There are others that, identify with their, European heritage. When I went to primary school, there was a lot of other kids that would say, I'm Irish, I'm Scottish, I'm, this and that. And, they describe the European nations where their ancestors come from. And for them, I think that the identity that was created by apartheid of natives and Europeans put them in a settler mindset where they saw themselves as settlers on this continent. And it's only now in the democratic dispensation where we've actually had to find things that connect us to this country. And whether it's, 400 years of ancestry on the continent, or whether it's, serving in the military forces or representing the country in sports since readmission post-democracy. There are many ways in which white South Africans can prove their loyalty, to the South African project. And I feel like it would be unfair to refer to them as settlers because they are the naturalized population. But to those that feel like, they've got dual nationality or dual loyalty or loyalty to, a colonial past, then I don't see them ever being seen as anything other than settlers, because their intention in the way they lead their lives on the continent is not to become one with the people of the continent, but it's to say, I'm an addition from somewhere else, and I'm just living on the continent. It's just I'm just domiciled here.
Can that not apply to black people also?
No, it can't. So, there is like this revisionist history theory that says, yes, there's a certain group of black people called the Bantus that, migrated from where the Congo, or whatever the case may be. I mean, the truth about migrations of African people across the continent is that it's been happening for hundreds of thousands of years. And they've moved around as the environment has changed, as the climate has changed, you know, because of droughts and everything else. But that is not a move based on them settling in a certain place to create a civilization or a culture. The civilizations that came down to Southern Africa did so deliberately because they did not want to live an agrarian life, you know, like an agricultural society. So because of the advent of, you know, agriculture, human labor became one of the biggest needs, you know, to get anything done, to feed people. So that's when indentured servitude came about on the African continent, right? The nations that moved down south were those that were opposed to indentured servitude or any form of slavery, as they would call it. Those that migrated along the equator, east and west, and even further north, they lived in agrarian societies and they had indentured servants. So culturally speaking, you know, the reasons for the settlements down here and the civilizations that were created were going against whatever values had started to become, you know, expressed by the societies that lived further north. Those civilizations came here long before any Europeans had arrived in the 15th century, in the 1400s, right? You look at the Xhosa nations that fought a 100 years war in the Southern Cape of resistance against the British. They were there since the early 1000s, you know, and they'd been settled there and they'd moved around in those areas. And because we hadn't created nations as a globe at that time, you know, it's not like the Spanish were a nation, they were a kingdom. The British were also a kingdom or an empire, the French, the same thing. We hadn't created nations. The concept of what South Africa is a modern concept. The nation state is a modern concept. And everyone that was or that is within the South African nation state, right, was here by the 19th century when that started developing in, you know, the early stages. And it only started developing within the 19th century. The arrivals of, you know, the first settlers started in the 15th century, you know, which is 400 years before that. So again, when they arrived at first, there was no South Africa to speak of. You know what I mean? Even if it was an entity that could be conquered or taken over or purchased or whatever the case may be, it wasn't there. It didn't exist. It only developed over time, over conflicts. And those conflicts, you know, you could call them violent negotiations, so to speak. You know what I mean? Although we're speaking now because we're not at war. You know, humanity has civilized beyond that point. You know, we don't have conflict like that. You know, we write documents, we take them to courts, and we sue each other now.
Do you really think so?
And I mean, individually, yes, you still get violent conflict, or maybe within certain organizations like gangs. But, you know, you won't find Zulu people going to the Lesotho border saying, hey, one of your guys said something about Zulu people, so now you guys would, you know, raining terror down on you. You know what I mean? But you would get, you know, warring taxi associations, you know, resolving their differences through gun violence or whatever. So it's not like a general thing. Whereas, you know, with the conflicts of the past, you know, when the British settlers arrived, they were at war with all the Xhosa nations that they found in the Southern Cape at the time, or all the Khoisan nations that they found, or all the Zulu nations. You know what I mean?
Note to, Yeah, but isn't that the nature of conquest?
You see, now that's the thing, is that conquest and is not part of our culture as the tribes of Southern Africa or the nations of Southern Africa. We're not conquesting. We don't do conquest. It's not part of our culture.
But what about the Zulus?
You know, it's same with them. You know, what you could call wars of conquest or actually wars of consolidation. The history of the Zulus, unfortunately, is written by the British as well. And the fort trackers will tell you about how honest the British can be. You know what I mean? So that history that's written doesn't take into consideration the fact that all those different tribes or nations had relations prior to the arrival of the British, had conflicts prior to the arrival of the British, had resolutions to conflicts prior to the arrival of the British. And they did things in a certain way. And the arrival of the British then, threw off, I guess, the balance of powers within the region. You know what I mean? There's a new invading entity that is technologically superior, you know, a more advanced war machine that came in to the fray. And from what we are told by Zulu historians about Shaka is that at the time that Shaka led what was the Zulu nation then, or what was composed of the Zulu nation, he wanted to consolidate the various tribes or the various clans into a force that could oppose the invading British and also have, you know, relations with the fort trekkers who were, you know, moving up into the inland and even further down into the Natal region of the country right now, or as far up as, you know, Mpumalanga, in the Piet Retief area. So you could basically judge this on this, the fact that there was trading relations that were established between the Sotho kingdoms and the Zulu tribes that lived, you know, just off, you know, the Drakensberg Valley. And the fact that they traded with each other shows that, you know, even though that they had conflicts, they weren't, you know, mortal enemies. They weren't just trying to eliminate each other, you know.
So what, if I'm following you correctly, just correct me if I've got this wrong. You're saying that the European history is one of mass violence and the one of black history is one of consolidation and negotiations and peace?
No, I wouldn't say it's consolidation and negotiation and peace only. Yes, there was violence involved, you know. But the technology that was used to, you know, enact that violence in Europe was far more advanced. You know,
okay, but on that, if the black people had the same technology, do you not think that they would have also had more severe violence?
Yes, they would have. But I also think that they did not invent that technology because they did not see the need to go to that extent. You understand what I'm saying? I feel like we could look at the development, or you could say there's a saying, you know, I don't know if it's really that accurate, but necessity is the mother of invention. Because of the type of conflict that was happening on the African continent amongst whatever warring tribes were here, you know, that level of conflict did not push them to invent killing machines that are on the scale those that we find, you know, within European conflicts, you know, things like, you know, gigantic cannons or machine guns or whatever you may call it. I mean, just think of it like this. If you're a Zulu warrior, right, and you've been fighting wars, you've been winning battles and everything else, all you know is that if you have to fight someone, it has to be hand-to-hand combat. And then all of a sudden, settlers arrive with magic sticks that fire pebbles, you know, from 1,000 feet away and strike you and kill you, you know. It's almost like, you know, it's a very, I don't know, it takes real evil to invent weapons, you know, that can kill someone who's not even looking or who's unaware from a distance, you know. You need to be remorseless. You don't find former military snipers that go and become kindergarten teachers, right? Because being a military sniper, killing people through a scope, you know, is traumatic, you know. And that act in itself, that type of violence, takes away something from your human essence that, you know, can never be replaced again once it's gone. So people who've come through that culture, right, have to accept that and normalize that within their societies. And now when they come into contact with people who believe in something completely different, you know, that's where the culture clash is exacerbated. And even when they do come to some sort of resolution, because they come from different cultures and understandings, you know, what is offensive to the other might not be offensive, you know, to the former, you know what I mean? And so we need to be careful that we are not saying things that will incite further hatred or incite violence, because we are not empathetic enough. Do you understand what I'm saying?
So, and you're saying that white people don't have that empathy, which is what you're talking about when you refer to Ubuntu.
No, what I'm saying is this, is that the white culture, because of the glorifying of conquest and conquering, you know, basically glorifies killing people. You know what I mean? Whether it be for a righteous cause or whatever the case may be, you know, they glorify that. You know what I mean? You look at, let's say, the Battle of Blood River. You know, the Battle of Blood River is about glorifying the fact that, you know, 400 four trekkers, four trekkers or Boers, you know, were able to ward off a force of thousands of Zulu warriors, you know, shooting at them with rifles. So what happens is that although for them they were defending themselves, right, their cause was righteous, when we celebrate it historically, we're actually celebrating the mass murder of native peoples. Now, what happens in that is that the empathy for the native peoples that were lost is gone in the celebration of the conquest itself, right? And it's very difficult to then depart from that way of thinking and then also think from the current perspective and think that although that happened in the past, you know, it could have been avoided. We're living in this country, all of us together. And if we're to turn back the clock, maybe just 110 years, you know, we would have been at war with bayonets and whatever the case may be. And if you were to tell those people who were firing guns at each other, or stabbing each other with spears, that their great-grandchildren would be going to the same schools. In 100 years, they wouldn't believe you. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so that's where I feel there's a lack of empathy on the part of, you know, white South Africans for the level of victimhood that Black South Africans suffered. And there's also a lack of empathy on the part of Black South Africans to understand the nature of the type of society Europeans lived in, and the fact that their type of conquest was completely, you know, completely inhumane, you know, but it was their culture. That's the way they lived there. You know what I mean? And you could either be defenseless and conquered and overrun, or you could defend yourself and establish yourself as a nation as well, that's competing within that sort of environment. And now when you take people from that environment and you bring them into this African context, you know, that culture, because it's been steeped in so much violence in its history, is completely incompatible with any of the cultures that are found here.
Okay, but now you have a situation in the current South Africa where the overwhelming majority of violent crime is black on black. Is that now a consequence of that history?
Yes, it is. The real reason is that South Africa is a tale of two countries, you know. And what has happened is that because there's established white enclaves where opportunity is fairer, within that enclave, side by side with also, you know, enclaves of black communities where opportunity is not as fair. And we find ourselves right now as black South Africans as crabs in a bucket, you know. It's nothing that should offend us as an observation coming from whether it be white people, Indian people, colored people, you know, because it's something that we are seeing acting itself out in everyday life. You know, there are too few opportunities for too many black people. And what that does is that now it forces them to compete against one another. And, you know, there's too much of an incentive.
Hold on. What do you mean compete against one another? Like who can rape the most women?
Well, look, I wouldn't put it like that. Because, you know, there is a tendency to criminalize black existence to the point of, like, we make black men synonymous with rapists, you know. But we've got a whole entire colored population that could only come about because European settlers came here to rape the native woman, to the extent that you've got a population of 5 million coloreds, which is even greater than the population of all whites, whether they be Afrikaner, British, Portuguese, Greek, you put them together, they are still less than the colored population. But you don't have the notion that white men are rapists, even though the history proves that white men are rapists to such an extent that they could create an entire race in a country as settlers, you know. So the crabs in a bucket, right, system comes about when, if we look through our history, black laborers were out competing Afrikaner laborers at the beginning of this country in the early days of the Union of South Africa. Barry Herzog, you know, who, you know, led what ended up becoming the National Party when it finally merged, and the Union Party, and the South African Party coalition. They came into power after the Boer workers started protesting and started organizing and created labor unions. And the labor unions were saying that Boer workers should be prioritized, and also no native or Indian or colored worker should earn more than a Boer worker, even if they're working in the same position. And, you know, that basically graded the labor of people along color lines. So if you're a white laborer, your labor is worth more than a black laborer. Therefore, if you got a lot of cheap black labor, you'll have a lot of black laborers, right? But they will never work themselves to owning means of production or anything of the sort. The only thing they could ever amount to be is like a really high paid laborer. Those really high paid laborers, you know, are the only ones that are able to support their families. Everybody else is still struggling. So even though they're working, they're still living in poverty. And that inequality that they're having amongst themselves, because they don't see each other as different, then makes them, you know, feel like one getting ahead means that they're doing that at the expense of the other. And that's where you get the black-on-black violence that you get. But with regards to how then it affects the relations with the different genders, let me give you this example. Let's say, right, South Africa was a white country, right? It was a white country. And then African settlers came in, right? And they basically brutalized all the white native men on the continent, and then took their wives, and then, you know, procreated, you know, creating a race of mixed race people. Would you feel that the white women that were the victims of this now said oppression would be justified by feeling betrayed by the white men who are supposed to be their providers and protectors, for not protecting and providing for them and allowing them to be conquered, whether, you know, they did so willingly or they did so because they were overcome by, you know, a force greater than they could muster?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yeah. Would you feel like it would be
justified? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know the answer. Well, I would need to think about that.
Well, it's what I've observed is, right, is that there's a lot of internalized anger that black women have, right? Because they were oppressed, and also because of our accepted gender roles culturally, they expected that the black men would be able to protect them, you know, from being conquered. You know what I mean? And so that dynamic also creates a gender conflict in black societies. So there's a minority of them that will, you know, internalize that and then lash out. And those are who you find are, you know, the rapists or the ones that abuse women, you know what I mean? And they're in the minority either way. However you look at the stats, you know what I mean? They're in the minority. But because black people are the majority, even though they're in the minority amongst black people, just the raw numbers themselves are staggering. You know what I mean? And unacceptable as well. You know, apart from even if they were even smaller, they'd still be unacceptable. But it's not about their numbers that makes it unacceptable, but it's the mere fact that, you know, it's become sort of like accepted culture. You know what I mean? And therefore, yeah.
Okay, Nota, let me ask you a question. Yeah. Okay. So you've suggested this a few times. So let me just feed into it. You've spoken about sort of the Afrikaner nation and the Zulu nation. So they're different nations. What therefore is South Africa and what is a South African?
Yeah, it's the diversity comes in the number of nations that come together and that unite to become South African, you know?
Yeah, but
to
what is
describe
that?
It and what a South African is, I guess.
Yeah, what is a South African?
That's very difficult actually to describe. I've never actually thought of if I have to define what a South African is, you know. But I guess the simplest thing is someone that's loyal to the country that is South Africa now as it exists, you know. I was born into South Africa, so.
But the country is just a politicized border, though, that was created effectively in the 1900s.
I think we've got all of the history of Southern Africa within this country. You know what I mean? We've got all of the people of Southern Africa within this country, whether some of them are citizens or visitors or immigrants, you know, we've got all of that. But I think that South Africa is not static and it's a work in progress, I think. And this work in progress is basically about creating what we feel would be an egalitarian and meritocratic society. Just in the same way as, you know, in 1777 or 1776, you know, America was established. And it was established with a certain intention. I feel like in 1994, South Africa was reestablished. And it was reestablished with a certain intention. You know, they coined the phrase, the Rainbow Nation. And I'd like to call myself or refer to myself as a Mandelite. You know what I mean? I believe in the Rainbow Nation project.
But why, though? I mean, it's very obviously a failure. Multiculturalism, multiracialism doesn't work.
I beg to differ. I think that it doesn't. It does work. I think I'm an example of it working.
Okay.
So I just look at myself, you know. I've got what they call Khoisan ancestry. I've got Xhosa ancestry. You know, I've got Tsonga ancestry. And I've got Sotho ancestry. And the only difference between me and a colored person is that, you know, we'd be classified as different races. But I come from a mixture of different nations, actually, that don't speak the same language. In fact, let me put it to you like this. When my parents got married, right, my mother's family believed that my father's family were cannibals. You know, that they actually ate human flesh. And and they had to learn.
that's a very awkward Sunday lunch.
Exactly. He's like, this is very nice. A little too nice.
Tastes like chicken.
So, you know, they came together. And it's funny, you know, it's funny now because I've had to live with this. So just imagine me as a 3-year-old child being told this story that, you know, my grandmother thought my other grandmother was going to eat my mother. You know what I mean? So we've been able to create multicultural families, you know, nuclear families in South Africa. And I feel like South Africa is the laboratory for multiculturalism. And you know what? I'm a Christian, right? It's Lent. So I don't know what faith you follow, but as Christians, we always look for certain things that confirm that this was God's intention. You know, we always, like all Christian societies, wherever they settle, they create manifest destiny myth, you know. So, I mean, I believe that, you know, Christianity originated in Ethiopia with the Orthodox Ethiopian Christian Church. But as it came to Southern Africa, right, because the different churches had, you know, different Bibles printed out, different interpretations, you are not going to get the true initial interpretation of what was written back then, however many millennia ago it was. But there are certain values in Christianity which I feel, or in fact, not that I feel, that I believe are consistent with the values of Ubuntu, which I believe in as well. And therefore, even if...
When you talk about Ubuntu, sorry, I'm interrupting, but when you talk about Ubuntu, what are you meaning?
It's an ethos. It's about common humanity. It's I am because you are, you know, and seeing one another as parts of a society other than individuals living out their lives. It's basically a socialist doctrine. You know what I mean? It's not your individualist Ayn Rand type of objectivist philosophy. It's
Africa has a massive history from bottom to top. So this entire discussion is mostly about Southern Africa, because everything kind of above the Sahara is an entirely different history.
Above the equator as well. Because we touched on it when I said that the Southern tribes have a different culture to the Northern tribes, you know, even in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
So that's why our culture is so different. And also another thing that, you know, I'm sure you find this a lot with a lot of black people. They think all white people are the same, you know, or they assume that all white people are similar.
Chinese people are the same.
So, you know, there's certain parts of Joburg where, you know, you'd find different groups of white people that dominate, you know, like in the south of Joburg, there's like places where you'd get like a lot of Portuguese people. There's places where you get like a lot of Greek people, you know what I mean? There's places where you get like a lot of Afrikaans people. So when you grow up in Joburg, you realize that white people are not the same. In fact, you know, I like a lot of the browner white people, like the Portuguese, you know what I mean?
I've got olive skin.
Let me call you an olive then. You see, the olives, they don't have that, I don't know, it's like, you know, a certain colonial esteem, you know, like the British people have, you know, the English people have. So you're more likely to find in Joburg an olive-skinned person that speaks multiple vernacular languages, or that can at least communicate a bit, you know? And even when they do speak English, they don't mind speaking in, you know, a black accent, so to speak, you know? Not because they want to act like the other person is stupid or whatever, but because they want to take away that imaginary, you know, superiority of the British, you know, cockneyed accent, you know, someone who speaks like they just got off the boat, you know, they just got off the Queen Mary, isn't really as approachable as someone, you know, who's lighter skinned than you or white or whatever, that at least speaks in, you know, a less, I guess, a correct or proper accent. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's what you find. So we know that difference. Whereas with white people that don't come from South Africa, right, outside of here, they don't understand the differences of different black people. Whereas South Africans do. You know, Bedi guys are different from Zulu guys, are different from Xhosa guys. You know the differences. And I mean, we do it a lot. And I think we got it a lot from our colonial, you know, education system. You know, when we were kids, there'd always be like little nursery rhymes or little jokes from the British Isles, where they'd have disses about each other. Scottish people would have jokes about Irish people, who'd have jokes about English people, who'd have jokes about the Welsh. You know, the case, we have the same thing in South Africa. You know what I mean? You diss your Portuguese descendant white brothers, you diss your Greek descendant white brothers, you know what I mean? Afrikaners, you know, we call them Dutchmen and all that type of stuff, you know. We have the same thing amongst black people, amongst each other, you know, across the board. And I don't feel like we should ever police that. You know what I mean? The fact that we do point out our differences, because we point out our differences to give each other an opportunity to understand each other's differences. But, you know, we're still together. And the mere fact that we're able to have dialogue, discourse, you know, conversations, we're able to go to the rugby or the soccer or, you know, the cricket all together, you know, even with all those differences, shows that, you know, multiculturalism does have a place. And I believe, this is my personal belief about South Africa, I believe that multiculturalism's home is in South Africa. And for me, what tells me that God intended it to be that way is the mere fact that, you know, your left leg is in the Indian, right? No. Your left leg is in the Indian and your right leg is in the Atlantic Ocean where you stand right now.
Do you think it's a good idea for black people to sing songs about killing white farmers?
No. And I've always believed that, you know, like things like singing or chanting of Kill the Boer should be banned. You know, I've always been opposed to that. Again,
it doesn't bring about Ubuntu, is what you're suggesting.
It does not. And it's the same thing as the celebration of, like, you know, I spoke about this earlier, so this is the same example, but in the converse instance, in that I'm also opposed to celebrating the Battle of Blood River as, you know, some sort of conquest. You know what I mean? It should be a part in our history where we look at how uncivilized we were. Like I said to you before, you know what I mean? You can't sing Kill the Boer and still want your kids to go to the same school with Boers. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I feel like they've intellectualized the significance of that song too much. You know, it's not even a great song. And I feel like we can compose better songs, songs that will bring us together. You know what I mean? And
that's, you're a lot more hopeful than I am.
Yeah, I have to be. You know, South Africa's got the highest suicide rate in Africa, you know, and black men are committing suicide at, you know, the highest rates. So I don't think there's an incentive to being a pessimist right now. I'm at high risk. So I need to be as optimistic as possible for my own sake.
Do you think Afrikaners should leave?
Well, look, I think that if you don't want to be in South Africa and you don't want to contribute to the project of making this multicultural society, then you've got no reason to stay. I think you need to be honest with yourself. And for me, I feel like the Afrikaners that feel hard done by the most by the system are the ones that have got the least chance of ever being able to leave in any other instance. If you've got like a degree, an honors degree or whatever the case may be, it's very easy if you speak English to find yourself work anywhere within the Anglosphere. You could find work in Australia, New Zealand, in the UK, even in the US. You could get like a critical skills visa, you know, you could be an H-1B or anything of the sort. So for those, there's never been a need to get asylum or seek refugee status. There's also a lot of left behind Afrikaners, white Afrikaners, left behind white Afrikaners, the poorest white people in our societies. And I travel a lot to the Vaal, which is south of Joburg in this southern part of Gauteng. And if you look at those communities within the Vaal, you see the poorest white people. In the Vaal, they have white car guards, almost exclusively white car guards at any of the shopping centers, you know, which is a shock to someone who's never been there before and never seen white people doing that kind of labor. But to me, it's not a shock because we need to look at our history. And from the first time we had elections in this country, people voted for separate development. You know, even with the referendum was more about integration into the broader Western world and the unsanctioned world than it was about, you know, redress for the oppressed black masses. You know, it was about, let's go into this democratic dispensation, which means everybody will be given the right to vote. And also, we won't be punished by the rest of the West with sanctions like we've been over the past half a decade, because that's how long, I guess, the height of the sanctions regime was from 1986 onwards. So with that in mind, I feel like there's too many people who have within them no reason to see themselves accepting that South Africa is a multicultural country and that it's black dominated. And they want to live in enclaves. They want to go to Orania or wherever it is. You know what I mean? And
isn't that okay? I mean, isn't that part of being in a democracy, the freedom to do that?
I think that you need to be in the country more than you need to be in the democracy. And I feel that a democracy also allows for a lot of things that are disloyal to the nation and the nationhood. And wanting to live in...
But there isn't a nation. But there isn't a South African nation. We know that.
I believe
that... We don't even know what a South African is.
The mere fact that we're still defining what a South African is shows how early we are in the development of a nationhood. We're 31 years in, you know, next.
So there might be a South African nation in the future is what you're saying.
I'm saying that we'd be able to clearly define what the South African nation is in the future. I feel like if you looked at the United States of America, in 1805, right, they would have been exactly as old as what South Africa is right now. The United States is turning 250 years old next year, you know? And I feel like the United States of America, from what I've seen, having been there and having traveled around, maybe I've traveled over 20 different states in America. And from that observation, it's a Christian white nation, right? And the culture is predominantly white and Christian. Yes, there's multiculturalism in that there's people of different cultures that form part of what America is now, but they are supposed to be assimilating to the culture that they find there instead of bringing their culture to America. You know, the African Americans all speak English. The majority of them are Christian. Same as, you know, the white Americans. They all speak English. Majority of them are Christian too, you know. Yes, there's people of Hispanic heritage, but they're all Christians as well. So although there's a language barrier, you know, they share a common religion. And that's why I'm able to define that country, which has composed itself after 25 decades, you know, into a predominantly white country that is mostly Christian. South Africa is even more Christian than the United States of America, right? So I'd say that South Africa is a black Christian country, right? And yes, we do have white people, we do have Indian people, or different groups of Asian people in this country. But what we should be aiming to do is assimilate them into our Christian culture. And because it's black dominated, then the black cultural dominance of that has been, you know, I guess codified in the values of Ubuntu. So we'd say, okay, fine, if you want to be a South African, you know, you need to adhere to the principles of Ubuntu. You know what I mean? Yes, you've got religious freedom, but you'd also accept that, you know, Christianity is the dominant religion in this country. You know what I mean? And also consider the fact that, you know, 500 years ago, there was no Christians in South Africa. You know what I mean? So we're flexible and we've accepted a lot from different cultures that have come into this place. And unfortunately, God put us here. We are the only country that has got on its coast two different oceans. So we've got the Indian Ocean Hemisphere, we've got the Atlantic Ocean Hemisphere, and this is the only place in the world where they meet.
What is the moral of the story?
The moral of the story is that, you know, we need to have these difficult conversations about the nation that we're trying to build. We need to be honest with one another, and we need to be honest with ourselves. There are some people who believe in the South African project. They might not be 100% believing that it will work out right now. They might have doubts. But they can only gain more confidence in the South African project if they actually work towards the type of outcome they would like to see. And their confidence in that outcome is dependent on how much effort they're willing to put in. And I feel like we need to impress upon one another and each other that we need to put more effort into creating a successful South African project. You asked me, what is South Africa? What is a South African? You know, I asked the same question, but differently, of a friend of mine. I said to him, what is South African food? You know, and we couldn't define it. But we've got the best Italian food in South Africa. We've got the best Greek food in South Africa. We've got the best, you know, of the whole of the world. You know, some of the best Indian food is available in South Africa. Even our South African street food is clean, you know, unlike the street food in India. So we've got the best of everything that the world has got to offer in one nation. And we're trying to build that into a society that humanity can look at as, you know, an example of unity and diversity. I think that's what our country's motto is, you know, diverse people unite. And I was born into that, you know, and I believe that for every day that I continue to live, you know, I need to fight to have that outcome of a united South Africa turn into a reality. And hopefully it will happen within my lifetime.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.